All right. Thank you so much for joining us, and welcome back to the show. And lucky enough, we've had a good run lately, Darren, a great run of guests. And this guy is no different. Guy that I've been following for quite some time. The proprietor, if you will, of TG Macro. And somebody that is on Real Vision. He's been all over the place and got some really interesting takes on the macroeconomic side. And anyway, without further ado, Tony Greer, thank you so much for joining us, and we're really pumped to have you on the show.
Hey, Zach, thanks for having me, man. It's great to speak cross country about markets.
Yeah, well, and this conversation, I know that our listeners can appreciate this. This conversation was supposed to start about a half hour ago, but thanks to seafare traffic and some wrecks. And it's funny, Tony, I know you'll get a kick out of this, right? You say Seattle, and everybody immediately thinks rain, right? I mean,
yeah,
right. Well, when you live here, the minute a drop of rain falls, everybody just flips out. I mean, it's the most bizarre thing, where you're just sitting there going, guys, this is Seattle, for crying out loud.
Yeah.
Just mayhem. But anyway, okay, so, Tony, before we get into this, one of the reasons I wanted to have you on was, A, I love your take on stuff. B, the guys that we really try to get on and that we like to talk to are guys that can tackle really complex issues and break them down in layman's terms, where everything isn't so esoteric and highbrow. You know, I feel like we got a lot of that in finance, right? And I love to talk to the real practitioners, the real guys that aren't trying to sound all erudite and, you know, sophisticated, that can, we can talk about it in plain language. And I've been impressed with you on that level. And then the other reason why, you do a lot of deep macro research, but you're one of the only guys I know that does macro research that has a deep trading background. That's the other, you know what I mean? I joke around with some other my buddies that run portfolios, and you know, you kind of separate the world of researchers and actual managers, and you straddle both those lines. Can you give us a story of your career and you know, what got you to where you are, and kind of your background and how you got your start in this business?
Yeah, sure, Zach. I came out of college at Cornell University determined to get a job on a trading desk because I am the son of a 30-year over-the-counter trader, my dad. And so, you know, trading conversation was dinner table conversation from the time that I was a kid, and I knew that's what I wanted to do. So to cut to the chase, you know, I worked at UBS and got a start at Sumitomo Bank, actually, for 2 years on the FX desk. Then I went to UBS for 2 years. Then I wound up joining Goldman Sachs, the J. Aaron division, which is their commodity trading division. And that was like joining the Yankees for me in terms of becoming a real trader. I really learned everything that I know about trading, about rigor, about how to apply, you know, narratives to storylines, to markets, and then get to the end game, which is actually making money out of nothing, right?
Yeah.
So you learn at Goldman Sachs at the J. Aaron division, when you're managing the commodity space there, you know, you learn about physical markets, you learn everything about the futures markets, you learn how to follow, you know, the merchants in the business and understand really what's the underlying movements of commodity markets are all about. And I really just basically, I apply that to the trading that I do today. I left Goldman Sachs in 2000 after the IPO and tried trading on my own for a year and a half. And it was exciting. And I started off pretty basically really well, and then got into just basically a churn for a long time. And I decided to go on to the sales side from there. So that's where I spent about 10 years after that on the sell side. And after jumping back and forth from a couple of shops, after having a great run at one shop, I decided to stop playing pickup basketball with my career and just go out on my own and apply everything that I've learned to, you know, helping people make money in markets. And that was basically, you know, that's the genesis of where I am now. I guess the important thing is that throughout the entire time I have been writing about markets on a daily basis for my own, you know, for my own notes and for learning about, for being a student of the market. And that turned into a daily note that I sent to my equity clients, which turned into the Morning Navigator, the newsletter that I'm the editor of, and publish every single day. So that's where I am now, man. Does that catch me up?
Yeah, yeah, and that's a lot of writing. You're putting that out every single day, right?
Yeah.
What does that process look like? What kind of wake up time are we looking at? Do you do it at night? I mean, what does that process look like? I'm fascinated by that because that's a ton of work.
Wow, that's cool that you recognize that because it is a lot of work, man. You know, it's very much modeled like a trading week, right? Like when I learned that trading weeks at Goldman Sachs, actually, I learned that, you know, your trading week starts on Sunday night. Right. And that's when you look at the Tokyo markets opening and you see how markets are trading in that zone and you watch price action and, you know, you carry that right through five sessions. And the close is really just one weekly close on Friday when you finally get to catch your breath. So that is how the application of my newsletter, I try to keep it the same way as I apply it to my trading. And you're basically, I set up a curriculum for the week of comments I want to touch on or news items that are coming out that I'm going to want to talk about. And then it's a combination between setting up my curriculum and then talking about the positions that I put on in my newsletter. That's really what takes up the bulk of my content. But putting it out every day is a discipline that I force myself to have because it forces you to vet out, what's really important in the market on any given day.
Yeah, we do see, here's one of the reasons I asked this question. We do or are attempting to do a weekly roundup email for our clients, just explaining, you know, what's going on in the markets and the economies in general. And managing the accounts, dealing with the clients, all the other stuff. It is so hard to stay on that regular schedule just because, you know, there's life coming at you. And, doing it every single day. I realize what a Herculean effort that is. And I think you use the word discipline.
I decided to make that in trading 100% of what I do. That was when I had to rip the Band-Aid off when I left the broker dealer side as an equity sales trader. And decided that I just didn't want to battle electronics anymore, you know, and it was really about saying, okay, I was going to have this discipline every day.
Gotcha.
And that's how the whole thing comes about.
Okay, now one of the other things I love is that it's funny to me to have a discussion about macroeconomics because, much the same way, you know, I grew up at a house where my dad was running the BD, and they were a broker dealer, but they specialized mostly in natural resource space. A lot of OTC stuff. So there's similarities there, you know, investing and trading and commodities and economics. That was just part of the family discussions, just part of the game. A big part of that for me, again, growing up was that macroeconomic backdrop, understanding what's making things move in the world. When I actually got out into the finance space, I was shocked to realize that that's not the normal approach, that a lot of people aren't looking at the macroeconomic picture. I feel like a lot of times it gets treated almost like, you know, voodoo or witchcraft. Oh, you're one of those macro guys, you know. And I can't imagine not being a student of that. One, I just think it's endlessly fascinating. But I kind of feel like it's almost like a short seller. Like macroeconomic guys are born. Right. They're not made. What got you? You must have an intense interest in this stuff. What got you on the macroeconomic side? How did that evolve?
To be honest with you, the first event literally that shook me from being, I would say, a literal pedestrian sort of coming out of college to saying, okay, I need to learn what the hell is going on here, was when I was in the Sumitomo trading room on the 107th floor of One World Trade Center, and George Soros, the Quantum Fund, was trying to break the British pound. And you would listen, you would listen to in an FX dealing room back then, everything was a voice broker.
Yeah.
And, you know, you would have to plug into their line. You had a direct line to all of them. You plug into their line to speak to them. But you literally had six broker boxes on your desk, all quoting different prices in the same currency cross. But all of the prices were bid offers that were correct bid offers. For example, in cable, you know, the bid offer would be, you know, 1.15, you know, 50 bid at 75. Just to quote a large spread. But what was amazing, the day that I heard the broker quoting the Soros side of the trade versus the Bank of England side of the trade. I'll never forget the price. It was one, the price of cable quoted over the box was 178.80 bid Bank of England, 178.78 offered Quantum Fund. So the price was inverted with the Quantum Fund trying to get you to buy all the pounds that they could from you through the Bank of England's peg, knowing that they were going to have to devalue. And I'm sitting there saying, what is going on here, man? This is insane. And then he broke it and the thing tumbled and I was addicted and that's it.
Yeah. Yeah. Then you get hooked, right?
That's it.
Down the rabbit hole you go.
Well, you start calculating how much money he made, you know, and that gets you excited.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Okay. So without further ado, then I would get into it. I was kind of licking my chops, looking at this because I really didn't, you know, you and I didn't even discuss this. There was no timing aspect, but coming into this week, realizing that, holy smokes, we got Tony on the show on Friday. I think we're going to have a lot to talk about. I didn't think we'd have quite this much, but let's start right in your wheelhouse. Let's start on an economic discussion. And to have an understanding, we're talking, this show's disseminated out on public radio in the Seattle area. So, you know, the vast majority of our listeners are retail investors or people that just got stuck in the car with this radio station on. So, and we have this discussion with our clients all the time. I think there's a big separation between what the average folks out there think is actually going on in the world and then what, you know, you and I know is going on. Kind of give us a backdrop.
Great,
you know,
point.
You don't have to get too granular, but kind of just give us a backdrop of where we are in a macroeconomic sense and the things that you're really watching with a U.S., you know, with attention paid to the U.S., but also the globe.
Yeah, you know, that's a great way to look at it. It is very much a global picture now. And Zach, now more than ever, especially since we're coming out of a pretty strict decade of globalism type of economics. So what's going on now, the way I look at it is I try to keep my eye on the biggest economies in the world and know what's going on over there, right? That's the short story, right? So I want to keep an eye on the U.S., on China, on Japan, and on Europe. And if I know that, you know, we're from starting point, you know, of the U.S. Economy running at 2.1% annual growth of GDP and China running at something like 6% GDP down from 8%, at least you have a starting point.
Yeah.
Right? You have a starting point to say, okay, this is these are two engines here and I can see sort of how hard they're firing. Right. So, you know, you want to keep an eye. It's important to keep an eye on China as one of the largest economies on the planet and growing, you know, because that's the engine that's pushing global growth. Right. You have to keep an eye on the U.S. because we're basically in the lead in terms of having the reserve currency and the most popular treasury bills and everything like that. So, you know, from the GDP, you start getting into where are interest rates in these respective countries. Right. And that's how you'll get another way of sort of comparing apples to apples. You know, so, for example, I rarely take my eye off of, you know, U.S. obviously the U.S. Treasury curve. But to just peg it somewhere, let's look at the 10-year yield at, you know, which just went through 2% yesterday to I think it's around 185 right now. I can call it up. Hang on.
Yeah,
it's around. So the U.S. 10-year yield is 185. And then, for example, the German 10-year yield is minus 50 basis points. Right. So you can see the differences in, you know, U.S. versus European credit markets and start to understand what's going on. Then you've got to get the central bank picture together. And what we've got going on right now is all central banks have just pivoted to a more dovish stance, which is an easier money stance. And that is to combat the slowdown in the manufacturing economy that has been caused by President Trump assessing tariffs on China. And that's the short story, if I can, you know, if I had to encapsulate it. But we can go from here.
Yeah, well, and that's what I wanted to get on with you, to kind of take the discussion in that direction, because you're on Real Vision all the time. You're doing pieces on there, and I love them. I love the stuff. Love the guys that you get on there and chat with. And
thank you.
There's been, you know, we had Recession Week where you know Raul did a bunch of deep dives and really looking at. you know, the whole global economy and looking at, you know, are we going into a recession? And I wanted to get your take on that. Where do you think we're at in this cycle? Where do you think we are at economically? What do you think is currently going on? And what is the trajectory that you are seeing us on? And where do you think that we're headed right now?
Yeah, well, you know, I try not to, Zach, this is funny, as a trader, I try not to think about where we're going.
Right.
I try to look at it and say, this is what we've got.
Right.
You know, and so if I had to look at it that way, I would say that, you know, the U.S. was absolutely firing post-Trump election. You know, what happened was we had the manufacturing sector and consumer confidence simultaneously take off. So that was interesting to watch, and it drove markets for quite a while. And then what happened was Trump came out at the beginning of this year with the tariff game, and that slowed everything down. So we've got to keep an eye on U.S. PMI, the Purchasing Managers Index, which is a really good indicator of manufacturing expansion or slowdown. And to break it down, basically the Mason-Dixon line is 50, reading of 50, right?
Yep.
And reading north of 50 means we're expanding. Read south of it means we're contracting.
Yep.
So we've fallen now. Our manufacturing PMI has fallen now from high 50s to the low 50s. So we're borderline contracting. We have seen the PMIs of European countries all go into contraction, essentially. China has gone into moderate contraction. And so we have to see what happens now. But industry has clearly slowed down around the world. What hasn't changed at all is consumer confidence. The consumer is still exceedingly confident. We just got conference board numbers yesterday. We just got University of Michigan confidence. We are at the highs of this move. So as long as the retail investor is still confident, we have the sort of offset to that manufacturing weakness because the consumer is the huge part of the economy. And that's what's sort of keeping things balanced right now. But I do think that we're at some risk. Obviously, these trade tariffs are a leveling of the playing field, and they are going to matter. And so, you know, if we have to pay up a little bit to get there, I think it'll probably be worth it, to be honest with you.
Couldn't agree with you more. I was actually on a podcast with Tobias Carlyle. You know Toby?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So I was on his show, and we talked about tariffs specifically, and my whole thing was it's been a fascinating conversation for me because people, you know, the anti-tariff guys come out and say, well, it hurts economic growth. And you look at them and go, well, yeah, I don't think anybody's are. I mean, maybe Trump believes, I don't really know, but I don't know any serious person that thinks that tariffs aren't harmful to economic growth.
Right.
I mean, of course they are. The question is it a price worth paying? And I guess the way I look at the tariff is we're going to pay the cost of the tariff one way or another. And I'd rather have this showdown on the ground that we choose at the time we choose, especially when we're still a bigger economy. Is that similar to your take?
Yeah, it's very similar to my take. I totally agree 100% on what you said. I also, I add in the caveat that we just came out of, you know, essentially look at, you know, 2008 to 2016 during the Obama administration was sort of peak globalism, right? And what that meant was that China was picking our pocket on global trade, and that costs you, right? That costs our country. And, you know, the headline that you can bash Trump about is the trade tariffs and they damage the stock market. And it's like, well, look up at the stock market. We're still at the all-time highs. But the reality is that it cost us a lot of jobs, right? Because, they said that the labor would come cheaper in China. And so that's what corporate America did. They sent the factories over there. And so that was a huge problem for the country. It caused, you know, what it likely partially contributed to the major opioid crisis in this country. And I don't mean to get too socioeconomic on you, but I feel like those things have to be considered when you consider why Trump is doing this. You know, I think that he's aware of what's happened. And I think that his number one thing is to bring jobs back to the United States. And the only way to do that is to take China out of the center of the equation and at least not let them be in charge and have, you know, a gigantic trade deficit, a trade surplus with the U.S. that they pay no tax on.
Right. Right. No,
go
ahead.
No, I'm just saying the reality of that is that that was completely outrageous. And if the media would have covered it as such, then the world would have been like, oh, I see why we're putting tariffs on them now to level the playing field. You know, everybody, nobody was complaining when China was picking our pocket with no tariffs on, you know, a $6 billion trade surplus or whatever the number is with us. A $6 trillion surplus with us.
Yeah, it's been a very bizarre, you know, and I get it. I get that Trump is a very polarizing figure. Mm-hmm. Like I said, we've joked around before on the show that he may have the worst bedside manner of anybody in public office, right? I get all that, but it's like people just get so focused that anything the guy does, it's horrible. And you look at him and the whole China, I mean, like you said, I think it's a great way to put it, pick in our pocket in so many ways.
Yep.
And that connection to the opioid crisis, I mean, you just see there's straight lines. I mean, this isn't tinfoil conspiracy type stuff, you know?
It's not. And
the other aspect of it too is the ongoing, you know, what are we, somewhere like $300 billion, the estimate is, of IP theft per year. And then the way that they are, you know, they want the fair trade argument just boils my blood, because what their definition of is give them unfettered access to our markets. And yet we've got to dance and grow, you know, we got to play all their games on their side. And I look at them and go, if you like fair trade, then you should love the tariffs. And they give you this kind of ridiculous look. But you go, hey, guys, it's more fair than it's been at any time in the last 25 years.
You make a great point, Zach. You make a great point. I love it.
Yeah, it's
spot on.
It's been fascinating to me. Now, you said something earlier that I'd really like to hear your take on, that we looked at it, and it really looks to me like China really started slowing at the end of 2016 before the tariffs came into play. What do you make of that? And now everybody's attributing it, right? This is the tariff global slowdown. It really looks like that was starting to happen prior to the tariffs. Do you have any thoughts on that? Did you notice that? Have you observed that same thing?
I did notice that they had slowed down off of their sort of firing, you know, what were they, 8.5% peak, you know, GDP or something like that. So they were definitely cooling off, and that was due to, you know, the banks had to restrict lending just a little bit because they're on pace for another year of record defaults.
Right. They're reporting.
Right. That they're just the ones that they're reporting. Exactly.
Right.
So that, you know, I mean, you know, the thing with China, Zach, we just have to take it at face value, or else we have to make that comment every single time we mention China data. You know what I mean?
Yep.
We have to throw the asterisk in there. So all we can do is take it at face value.
Rate of change.
The market is going to trade off, right?
Yep. Yeah. No, I totally agree. I have called into question the quality or the integrity of their data on multiple occasions. And then in that same argument, or in another economic argument, I'll hear myself quoting their rate of growth. And just some incongruency there I've found in my own arguments, where I'm like, wait a second. You can't sit there and say the data is incorrect and then start throwing it out in another part of your own argument, you know?
Exactly.
We like you said, we got to play the world as we see it, and that's the nature of it. So
I'm with you. I'll say the data comes out and I will sit here and flat out not believe it, but the market is trading off of it anyway.
Yeah. Well, and then that's the beautiful, unique aspect of this market, right? Like Buffett says, on a day-to-day basis, the market's a drunken psychopath, and that's true all times. But look at the run-up we've had, Tony, so far this year, based on the idea of a trade deal. You know, I don't have contacts in the State Department, but these people that think a trade deal is right around, I don't see it. I don't think it's close at all. I don't think it has been close. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I agree with you 100%. I was saying that the whole time most traders that paid attention to that feedback loop that you just mentioned, whereby every time they mentioned that there might have been dialogue, the market would rally, right? So we're not even talking about resolution. We're talking about 25, 30-point S&P rallies on the mention of potential dialogue. You know, that's when you know that there's something going on, right? Like, it makes no sense that there would be a resolution happening any time soon, but the market is acting like it is. So I totally agree with you that China is playing a long game with us. We're you know, Trump obviously got put the pressure on the Federal Reserve to ease and ease big because he was ready to come back at them with more tariffs because he wasn't happy with their timetable.
Yeah.
Right. So here we've got Trump trying to force the issue. And I don't think that they would do that. You know, and he's making it more difficult by putting more tariffs on them. Right. So we're going to eventually come to a head. But I don't think it's anytime soon. Like, I don't think it's going to be any time before the 2020 election. And that's really the only data point that matters. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's a one horse town as far as that data point goes.
Yeah. It's kind of, you know, to me, it's either he solves it before the election or he doesn't. Right. And so I got a feeling that he maybe is putting pressure on them. So maybe he can deliver a resolution for the election. You know, in order to get there, he's got to start getting a move on now. But I don't know. That's pure speculation. And it could go through the election. But I don't think it's generally going to hurt him.
Well, the other
economy is still in good shape.
Yeah. Yeah. The other thing that I think is really interesting to think about is if you put yourself in China's shoes. And again, it goes back to the conversation I was having with Toby. There's a part of me that feels now we're speculating, obviously, and we're doing it because it's fun, at least for me. Yeah. Just talk about the theoreticals and what could happen. But sure. if you try to really take a step back and look at it from at least from my perspective, I almost feel like if China comes to the table, that is going to worry me more about the internal state of their economy. Because I don't think they can play it straight. I don't think that they can keep on their rate of growth or their current, you know, the current setup in the Chinese economy. I just don't think it can continue if they are playing it straight. Not playing it straight has just been way too much of a boon for them.
Yeah.
So I'm looking at it going, man, I think if they come to the table, that I might be more concerned. You know, and the flip side is, if you're in China's shoes, wouldn't you just sit back and wait to see who wins the next election? I mean, you know, unless you are forced to do a deal because things are about to unravel, what upside do you have of trying to get a deal done with Trump? You know, whatever it's going to be way tougher than whoever takes office next.
Yeah, I don't know, though. I don't think if you're China, I don't think you want another 4 years of economic agony. You can't risk that. You know, you can't risk, you know, sitting back and see who takes office next is a crazy idea. If the record has shown that when the economy is strong and the markets are strong, the president gets a second term. Right. So, I mean, this is they would be betting against history and against math to say, oh, you know what, let's just wait until 2020. Maybe this guy's gone and we get it off our back. I don't think there's a chance of that. I mean, there is a chance, but I don't think that's a likely or safe thing to bet on for China, because if it's another 4 or 5 years of this, or 2 or 3 years of this even, their GDP growth might be down to nothing. And that won't be good for the global economy either. So, you know, everybody's got to be careful with what they're wishing for here. But I would agree with you that if China came to the table, it would mean something really significant, meaning like, you know, I would sort of read it as, okay, that's it. That's uncle. And we need to get, you know, Trump off our back somehow and figure out a solution to this tariff and make a deal and say, we'll pay you for this. We won't pay you for this. And see where it gets us. So
yeah,
know, it's very difficult to speculate. You know, I try to take it day by day and see what the market gives us.
Yeah, no, and that's a sane, rational, sober way to look at it. So we got to take a quick break. But you brought up currency trading, and I'm glad you did, because that's the next thing I want to get into. So stick with us through the break. We'll come right back and we'll get into the currency side of it and get your take on that.
I'm here, man.
All right, pal. All right, guys. Well, hey, once again, listening to Tony Greer, we got to take a quick break. We'll be right back. Stick with us. This is Know Your Risk Radio on AM 770 KTTH. All right. Welcome back. Thank you so much for sticking with us. And as a reminder, we are lucky enough to be joined by Tony Greer of TG Macro. He is a professional trader and runs a research firm, and you're supplying research mostly to RIAs or a lot of, you know, what, small family offices, that kind of stuff?
I have a really wide variety of clients that I have, Zach. It's really a great it's one of the things that I've loved about leaving the broker-dealer side and having only a hedge fund or a mutual fund as a client. You know, now since I've gone off on my own, I have a sort of level of portfolio manager clients. I have a level of sort of execution desk trader clients that are, you know, in the hedge fund and mutual fund side. And then I have a ton of wealth advisors that have been latching on to my note for idea generation. And then I've got a lot of just individual traders. I've got RIAs. I would say that I am probably about 20 to 25% wealth advisors, which is a pretty cool bulk to have. They're a great client base. They're some of them are family offices, like you mentioned, and they're all great people to work with.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Okay. So getting into the, it sounded to me like when you were talking about your history, that FX trading, currency trading is near and dear to your heart. Was that a correct assessment?
Yes, sir. That's where I started. Those are my original roots.
Okay. So I'd be remiss if we didn't get into a dollar discussion. Where is the dollar headed? I haven't even looked at DXY this morning. Where are we at right now? Do you know?
Yeah, I'll tell you where we are, and I'll tell you, I can give you my assessment in a sort of nutshell, right? We are now at 98 in the dollar index, right?
Yep.
That puts us at the top end of the sort of 96, 98 range. I could argue that we've been in all year, right?
Yep.
Then I can tell you that that range is at the epicenter of the sort of 88 to 105 range that we've been in for, call it, the last 5 years.
Yep.
And my view on the dollar is that I am a terminal king dollar bull.
Gotcha.
Right? I posture myself as a dollar bull because rationally, it is still the best center to invest and probably the safest center for your dollar. So it's going to have that premium attached to it. So that's why I just stay bullish the dollar. I stay out of the existential arguments that take place on FinTwit about the dollar as reserve currency, because I believe firmly that it is going to retain its status and that's not going to change. And just sort of play the dollar from a neutral side, because the reality is all of the central banks are currently easing and diluting their currency in some fashion. So it seems to me like it's a coordinated currency dilution, and the dollar is the sort of shock absorber in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that's how I look at it. You know, like the euro was, you know, remained firm against the dollar for a little while, and now the dollar's strong and it's backed off. But you've got cable coming apart because of the no-deal Brexit potential of Boris Yeltsin. And then you've got some other currencies. You know, you've got the yuan coming apart this morning because Trump is, you know, establishing another level of tariffs. So there's another level of uncertainty there. So we've got a three sigma slide in the Chinese yuan. That's a huge move. And so these are the sort of things that are all moving against the dollar while the dollar is sitting here right in the middle of its range. So I try not to lend too much weight to the dollar position or price and just sort of maintain a pretty bullish posture toward it. You know, if it broke below 95, I may get a little bit concerned that we may go to the bottom of the wider range. If it broke 100, I may get concerned that we may go to the top of the wider range. But I still think the dollar is going to remain in a super tight range with the central bank behavior that we're seeing.
Gotcha. Okay, so what do you, again, getting into your philosophy and your look at things, if you think the dollar, if you're a dollar bull right now, would that intimate that you are leaning more toward continued economic hardship, maybe more contraction abroad? Is that part of that dollar bull outlook?
The dollar does act as a wrecking ball sometimes.
Yeah.
Right? So the dollar can rally and, you know, for example, you know, take the Turkish lira apart. You know, and you see things like that, and you'll see it really, really weigh on emerging markets, right? And on occasion, it'll rock the peso and things like that. So, you know, the dollar does act like a wrecking ball, especially to emerging markets because they're the most fragile and there's the first place that capital runs from, right? There's always a capital suck back when there's an event that takes place in an emerging market. I do think that there are, there are other moves out there that you definitely have to monitor because the dollar does tend to do some damage. damage when it gets firm. But it seems like the other currencies are all kind of taking their turn doing these little tumbles against the dollar. And the reality is the only one that matters right now, in my opinion, is the yuan and the Indian rupee. You know, because those are the two big drivers of the energy market right there, China and India. And so, you know, I just want to keep a close eye on those currencies to make sure that they don't get, you know, too severely weak to a point that their central banks have to interact, you know, because that could be read as a sign of weakness, et cetera, et cetera. So there's just some things to keep in mind with the global balance there.
Okay, so now on the yuan, well, I've, again, this as much for my edification as it is for the listeners, because I have never traded FX, not once, never done an FX trade. I mean, I've done trades based on currency movements, but you know, not something that we do on the, you know, for our clients, for a variety of different reasons. I feel like if you haven't spent a substantial amount of time like you have being in that world, and especially on the institutional side and sitting on a desk, I just think you're at a horrible disadvantage in that world. But so I'm a bit of novice on the currency side of it, but I've been watching this whole renminbi / yuan of China's, and realizing that, you know, right now it's bumping up against very key levels to the downside. And the, a lot of guys a lot smarter than me have made the assertion that it's going to be a key thing to watch, and that if China is forced to devalue substantially, that it will send a massive wave of economic strife through the globe. Is that your take? And if it is, can you explain the mechanics of why that would be so devastating, a big Chinese devaluation?
Yeah, I do think that there, you know, you have to certainly assign, you know, the way I like to look at it, Zach, is to not force myself to say, okay, do you think this is going to happen or not going to happen, and figure out what the right probability is, right? Because there is some probability of not, there is some non-zero probability of China yuan devaluation, right? So right. We have to consider what could happen when that happens. So if you say that we are going to devalue the yuan and it starts blasting through 7 per dollar toward 8 or 9 or something like that, what happens then is you have a big game of capital flight, right? So the first thing that you'll see is you'll see money come out of all of the, you know, China and neighboring economies. You'll see, you know, the China yuan weaken dramatically. You'll see the Aussie dollar weaken dramatically. You'll see their stock markets weaken dramatically alongside that, as money comes out of those centers due to the risk of a severe economic downturn.
Gotcha.
So that's basically the start of what happens. You know, instead of there, if you know, if you picture it being a run on a bank where all of a sudden depositors want to pull their money out, this is, that would be a little bit like a run on a country.
Right, right. And then that
where investors, yeah, want to pull their money out. Then you see, you know, that's obviously, those are the moves. Those are the transactions that are moving the yuan market. Right. It's not just a disco ball out there. Right. People are trading yuan for dollar on this price, and that's why it's moving so far. So the reason it's moving so far is because they're pulling the capital out rather than this is causing the other. So that's an important way to look at it, because when you have money pulling out of currency markets, out of bond markets and equity markets, and then out of the currency market, you've got a lot of cross-border action going on, and that's what, you know, sort of wakes up markets and spikes volatility, if that's fair to say.
And it's fascinating stuff. So in that vein, and again, without trying to make extrapolations of what's going to go on in the future, because, I think there's a lot of from my perspective and the chair I'm sitting in, I think there's a lot of concerning things out there, a lot of concerning economic numbers. Certainly the trajectory right now is in the wrong direction. Yet at the same time, especially here in the U.S., well, mainly here in the U.S., I was having this discussion with our analyst just yesterday. I said, he and I were agreeing on this, but hey, yeah, things are not headed in the right direction. But a lot of these indicators we've looked at have been, you know, materially worse at different points along this expansion, and we didn't end up going into recession. So, you know, taking everything with a grain of salt, I think predicting where we are economically over the next 12 months is one of the toughest things. You know, that to me just feels like it's almost impossible to handicap, which is why I completely agree with your take, we play it the way we see it. But with that in mind, what are you focused on right now? What are the things that, you know, if you had your bullet point to tell investors, look, these are how we see, or these are the things that we've identified is what we are focused on right now. This is these are the hinges. What are those?
Right now, I'm wildly focused on the dynamic where this rally in the bond markets, and especially in Europe, is causing an expansion of the pool of negative yielding bonds. Right? Is that, can we cover that territory here?
Oh, 100%.
It's a little bit complicated, right? But we've seen German yields go from, you know, sort of call it 10-year yields, go from plus 50 basis points to minus 50 basis points, where you're now paying Germany to hold your money, right?
Yeah.
Totally different dynamic. Completely insane dynamic. I mean, we have left the building, right? Like, this is in Never Never Land. So yeah. We have to figure out what this is going to mean to the market. But what the biggest thing that I'm following this for is, because of my metals trading background, we know that a metals length in gold or silver, which you do not have to pay interest on, you only have to pay storage on, is a better investment than one that you have to pay interest on. Right. So what happens then is you have money rushing into precious metals when that pool of negative yielding securities expands due to the ferocious bond rallies that are going on in Switzerland and in Germany and in France. So now you've got more and more of these countries' yields going curves going negative yield. And so investors are saying, you know what, I'd rather own gold or silver, and I'll take my chances with the price appreciation, because as a store of value, they're really not that volatile, right, compared to the equity markets, right? They're a low volatility item. So you've got money rushing into precious metals, and I think that that's a massive, massive trade right now to be following. Since the beginning of the global central bank pivot to dovishness, which basically occurred, I would say, the end of May or so, the Bitcoin and gold and silver have woken up and started rallying. So sort of as bond markets rally and that pool of negative yielding securities expands, people buy more and more gold and silver. And I think that there's a massive opportunity for those markets, which have now broken out of technical patterns, to really rally. So that's a big focus of what I'm looking on now as it relates to the global macro trade. The note actually that I wrote this morning was about how moves in the bond market can put you into a metals trade.
Yeah, no, and that's we've been, you know, keeping an eye on gold specifically. Really, since I've been in the industry, I've kind of got that in my background. So I'm always keeping an eye on gold, you know, not a gold bug, but realizing that, you know, you can get some really big moves. And I feel like the recent momentum here in gold has obviously been impressive. One of the things that impressed me was just in the last day, we've settled down a little bit. We're at about 1455. It looks like, at least the quote I'm getting on gold right now. But the way it just blew through 1450 and has held there, I thought that was pretty impressive. Are there key levels that you're watching on gold, and where do you think we are in this gold advance? Have we hit those key levels, and where are those levels where you sit there or you're just going to sit there and say, all right, people, we're officially broken out. We think this baby's running a lot higher, or are we already there?
We're there, baby. We're there. That's why I'm, it's fun to listen to you're sort of neutral about, it's fun to listen to somebody that's sort of neutral about the gold price talk about it, because you'll hear my view of it in a second, and it's very different. Now, there was nothing wrong with your appraisal of the gold market. You were spot on. We just have different breakout levels. But I look at gold now as, man, this is a huge weekly close today at 1440 something, right? We are literally $5 or $10 from the high of this move, which started to me back at 1150 in 2018 when gold bounced off to sort of the bottom of the channel that was trading in.
Yep.
And so now it took off and attacked the top of the channel, and I think we broke out at 1375.
Yeah.
So that's now a huge, huge, huge support level for me, because we tested it so many times on the upside and we weren't able to break through. Now we're through. So the seller is gone. buyers have taken over, and we're literally right now, and especially with this weekly close, in a sort of trajectory to find where this rally is going to pan out. And in my opinion, I'm pretty confident that we should be attacking the 2011 highs of 2000 at some point. So this is a really exciting trade to be in right now.
Hey, from your lips to God's ears, buddy. I may sound impartial.
Right.
I may sound impartial on it, but we've had a max long position on it. Well, and we were out of it for a long time. Again, being around the industry, when it's wrong, you just you pick up your chips, you go home. You don't play. You know, you got to let that baby turn around, because it can be a house of pain. And I've lived it. But we went. Let's see. We put on our max gold position. I want to say at about 1280 or 1290, and we've been sticking with it. We've traded around it a couple times here and there, but stayed pretty max long. And I'll tell you what, that 10% position in the miners that we've got, it sure felt good yesterday. It really acted as a it really acted as a buoy, and we were fortunate enough to have a nice long vol position too, and that helped as well. So you think this is part of the ascension to new highs, or at least to go test them again? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I do, and I think, you know, what's nice is that for a change, the logic path lines up with and agrees with the price action. You know, when you've got the premise beneath the gold market that I described before, with the negative yielding securities driving people into that market, and the price appreciation agreeing and confirming the technical breakout, you know, these are the kind of trades that you really sit up in your chair for, because, you know, it's panning out as it should right before your eyes. And I actually entered, you know, in my newsletter, and I'm timestamped for all the positions that I enter. We put on an upsized GLD position on May 31st when gold broke above all of its moving averages for the first time in months. The close that day was 1305. Gold was up about $25. But for me, it's easy to buy gold up $25 when it's breaking out and breaking through a pennant pattern and going to attack the next high level. So that was a really good entry point for us, and I'm staying in the trade right now. We're still upsized. I'm still looking for upside, and I've added silver on the silver breakout to the portfolio, and that's going really well too. So, you know, these trades are like, I'm literally highly focused on the everything from, you know, the daily closes to the intraday price action to how much volume they're opening on, and I'm really dialed into these moves right now.
Yeah, we're about, so we don't spend nearly as much time talking about silver. I don't have as much experience in it, but again, very familiar with the market moves, and you know, I know that it is it really has not caught the wind or the momentum that's in gold sales right now, and it's certainly a laggard. Where are the price levels that we're watching on silver? Because we hit wasn't the 2011 high right around $50?
Yes, exactly. I'm trying to put that up on my screen right now so I can see. Yeah, it got about as high as 45, and then we peeled back from there. The 2011 high. Yeah, we got as high as $48 exactly.
Yeah,
in May of 2011. So then it was, you know, it was basically just a slow grind lower from there till we breached in 2014. We started straddling $15 in the silver price, and that's basically been the story. But if you get technical with me for a minute, silver, the story there is a backstory. And I'll take the time to tell it right now, because it's actually worth paying attention to, because I think something happened in the precious metals markets about 2 weeks ago when silver really, really jumped out of bed, right? Silver was sitting there literally minding its own business at around 15 and a quarter and took off, traded to 1650 in about 3 or 4 days, right?
Yeah.
So you look for explanations for a move like that, right? And I was led to that my sort of, my search for it led me to the gold-silver ratio. And what's really amazing about the gold-silver ratio is that we just traded from a low of about 30, as in ounces of silver per ounce of gold, to 90, where it takes 90 ounces of silver to buy an ounce of gold. And that has gone along with sort of that trade that I described, where people started investing in precious metals to combat that negative interest rate. or to trade on that negative interest rate. And if you look at the ratio, it looks like somebody said, you know what? Silver is way too cheap to the price of gold up here. You know, it's at historically high levels. Let's just go in and start by putting an allocation into the market in the silver market instead of gold because silver is so cheap. So I think that that's what actually happened, and that's what was responsible for that silver spike to 1650. And what's so interesting about silver is that we have no idea where it could go on the upside. I mean, it's truly the rich man's casino. So it's worth having that position on if you're sort of a momentum junkie in the trade sense and, you know, want to have some potential upside there because, you know, you do have downside risk. But, I mean, I wouldn't be shocked if silver tripled from this price over the next couple of years, you know. So you've got that kind of potential and you've got to be in trades like that.
Yeah, and, one of the interesting things, too, we've seen, you know, throughout both of our careers, we've seen incredible rallies in metals markets before. It's not new. Yet at the same time, one of the things that's captivating to me is that we've never lived through a period of time where we were looking at what appears to be the beginning of another bull market in the metals and in an environment where you are having to pay to own. And again, this is a relationship you were just pointing out, but clients ask me all the time, Zach, how high could it go? And I go, you know, I'm not going to speculate. Who knows?
Right.
But we've never seen a metal breakout at the same time that you had to pay for the privilege to own or to lend sovereign governments money.
Right.
And then you look at Europe, you're paying for the privilege to lend certain companies money as well. You've got negative yielding corporates. I mean, you may have a theory one way or another, but if you're asking me to have to pay to lend already structurally insolvent governments money as opposed to owning gold, we grew up in you got me by a couple years, but all of our experience has been in a world where owning those precious metals cost us in the sense that we weren't earning the interest that we otherwise could. There was an opportunity cost. And so you were hoping for capital appreciation. That opportunity cost has never been lower. And in that way, you kind of look at both those markets and go, holy smokes, I don't know. I don't know where it can go. But I mean, it could be Katie bar the door.
Yeah. The important thing, Zach, I think for all adult investors, right? If you've got money that you're trying to protect, if you've got a nest egg, you know, you've got to have that allocation in some way to the gold and silver market. And I would recommend physical metal. Like, I think, you know, everybody at some level should own some percentage of their net cash balance, so to say, you know, your net worth in gold, in literally actual coins. It's the sort of sleep at night policy against these central bankers destroying your currency because God forbid and this is something that I have a very low probability of, but God forbid you ever have to live through a currency devaluation, the gold is really going to probably appreciate massively and hopefully pick up a lot of the tab on your wealth that got crushed.
Yeah.
So it's just important to have that allocation just in case.
The other thing that's got me excited about the metals is, and there's always been detractors. There always will be, but I don't know that, certainly in my career, in the last 13 years, I can't think of a time where I've heard more people and even more respected people scoff at the idea of owning gold. I mean, at least from my perspective. Now, in the circles you swim in and the people that I'm talking to or listening to would probably be the better way to put it. There are a lot of gold fans now in that group, but that's a relatively small group of people. I mean, you're not seeing specials on CNBC about gold miners. I mean, it couldn't be more out of favor. you know what I mean?
Yeah, I love it. I totally agree with you. You know, that's why it makes it, number one, that makes it a little bit easier to invest in right now because it's not like a front page item, right? We're not buying Apple at the all-time highs. You know, it's like you said, it's a very under the table trade, and there are a set of people that believe in it, and there are a set of people that think that you're crazy.
So I got to take advantage of these opportunities here. So we've talked about all this, you know, all these different things. The one thing we haven't talked about is the markets in general, the equity markets, U.S. equity markets. We're sitting here today, you know, all the pomp and circumstance, all the celebration, everybody fired up. Greatest start to the year since 1997. Hey, look where we're trading at today. We are now 5 S&P points below the previous all-time high that was set in September. Where do you think we're at in equity markets? Are there levels in that you're watching? Is that something you're paying attention to?
Always. I am an equity ranger by birthright. So yes, I'm always watching the equity market, and a lot of my clients are looking to me for equity guidance.
Right.
I start from a position of you can wake up bullish or you can wake up bearish, and I choose to wake up bullish every day.
Gotcha.
Right, because we're, you know, in the big picture, the S&P broke out of a double top above 1500, and we haven't seen where it's stopping yet.
Right.
Fact. Period. We do not know where this rally is over. So I'm not going to say that we just touched the highs above 3000. That'd be insane, right? We are not going to pick up nickels in front of a steamroller and try to call the top of the equity market when you can look around on FinTwit and see there's plenty of people doing that.
Yep.
And making themselves look ridiculous, right?
Yep.
So I choose to wake up and be bullish. Obviously, you know, you get different degrees of bullish. And I would say sort of, you know, along the highs here, I think everything looks just fine. I really do. And when you saw the response of Steve Mnuchin and the Treasury Department to that debacle that we saw last December, you know, you get a little bit more confident that the Fed is telling you that we may have taken your savings rate away, but we are protecting your nest egg here, whether that's a written mandate or not.
Right. And whether it's good or not, again, it gets back to your point of we got to play the game in front of us.
Exactly. You always have to assign some probability that they may pull the rug out from under you one day, and Steve Mnuchin might just say, "Oh, I don't care that the S&P is down 1,000 points," and not do anything about it. But the chances of that are probably really low.
Oh, I couldn't agree with you more. I get accused of being a perma bear all the time, and I kind of sit back in my chair and I go, "Whoa, hold on a second. At no point have we not owned equities over the last 10 years? At no point."
Right.
Now,
right,
there are times where you dial that exposure back, but, you know, I'm not a perma bear. We've got a macroeconomic top-down view, but we're also value-focused. So I kind of say that we're a value shop with a macroeconomic underlay or overlay, if you will. And so the valuation side of it has gotten really tough. Just because I'm seeing valuations that are just nosebleed that I didn't think that we'd see them again. It's hard to swallow. Yet at the same time, in the world that we're looking in, you know, or the world that we're living in, the world that we're investing in, like you said, you know, if you told me 16 months from now the S&P was 30% higher than it is today, I wouldn't bet. I mean, I'd say, okay, you know, I wouldn't sit there and say that's an impossibility. I'm not saying at all that's a projection.
Right.
But are there levels? Are there things that you're watching? You know, again, we're not trying to predict the top because that's insane. And how many times? And I've fallen victim to it. I thought there was a good chance we might have put a top in December. Now, we bought during that. We were fortunate enough to buy. It was scary. Didn't buy in size, but picked up some, you know, positions here and there. But I thought one of my big concerns is the top could be in. And again, the reason we didn't position that way is for what you said. You know, I'm not picking up nickels in front of a steamroller. But are there levels? Are there points where you're concerned? Are there points where you're going to – are there things you're watching? You don't think that this level now, this 29 – we're at 9 now on my chart, 29.24 on the S&P – this is an unusual amount of time for a market to trade sideways, and it fits into the rounded top thesis. But kind of walk me through your thoughts on that.
Sure. I think that, you know, despite the Fed rate cut, you know, despite we saw a little bit of a sell the fact event to the Fed rate cut, and then Trump came in and trampled the market with his new tariff on China.
Yep.
Right. What that has done is driven the market back to its moving average. The 50-day and the 100-day moving average come in between 2,900 and 29 and a quarter. So I think that this is a good support level to start here. And my level that I'm watching, that I'm keying on, is the 200-day moving average down at 2790, which coincides with the beginning of June low at around 27 and a quarter. So 27 and a quarter, 27 and a half, somewhere in there is a really huge level for the S&P on the downside. I would definitely be moving money into the markets there if we get to see it, if we're fortunate enough to see it. And I think that the Fed left room open for another cut should things go wrong. You know, it seems like a mid-cycle cut in reference to those PMI slowing down that we talked about, and possibly in respect to the three-month 10-year spread in the bond market, which has basically collapsed to zero and has indicated a recession more times than not when that happens. So there are things to be concerned about. And I think the Fed is going to continue to manage it, but I like I said, I'm not going to. That's not going to change my view of waking up bullish or waking up bearish in the S&P and waking up bearish one day, because I still want to be an equity market bull. I still want to be, you know, in the mix looking to buy dips. That's still been the right thing to do. You know, I like you get caught up in things. And back in the last quarter of last year, if you recall, that's when Mohammed bin Salman took out Jamal Khashoggi in the beginning of October.
Yep.
And markets literally unraveled from there. But by the time we got to, I guess, November, I told my clients, look, man, the S&P is covering a lot of ground here. It's making me nervous. And I would definitely take some money out of the markets for a little while till this volatility passes. Right. Yeah. And so we had a chance to take some money out. We weren't fully boatloaded long for that whole dip down to 2300. You know, it got back to the starting price, got back up above all the moving averages, and it may have cost us, I don't know, 100 S&P points. But after that, I said, okay, you know what? Things look good again. I feel better about this. It looks like the Fed is going to literally step on this thing until, meaning sort of step on the gas on the S&P until it's back trading to the levels that it was at. And that's exactly what happened. So, you know, you kind of get used to that pattern recognition. You get used to that sort of backstop being there, and you keep trading off of it. You know, you just keep trading off of it until it burns you. And it really hasn't burned you that bad. If you just, you know, if you are saying, okay, steep dips in the S&P price are to be purchased.
Yeah.
And if you have that attitude, then you say, you know, like you said, it's scary, but you put money to work because you've got it sitting there for a reason. And when the S&P goes on 15% sale, you buy it. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. No. And I think you brought up something, you know, I hear on the bear side again, you know, so many of these guys, you know, making the argument, oh, the Fed's going to make, I do not see the Fed making a mistake on the tight side. I just do not see that. That is not going to happen this time. The risk is running too loose. I mean, you look at the excesses that have built up in the system. You look at debt levels. The Fed's not stupid. Well, now I'm talking out of both sides of my mouth. I've got some serious issues with the way that Fed deals with things. But again, it's not my place. We got to play the field as it lays. But I just don't see there being any possibility that this ends because the Fed tightens up too fast. I mean, I just
no. I agree. The reason why I think is because Europe is, you know, in such bad shape right now that they've got rates, you know, they're pinning rates at zero. They're talking about another leg of quantitative easing. I mean, you know, they're in bad shape over there. And then if you have China slow down, you know, then you risk the U.S. running into a recession. And that's the whole fear. That's the whole thing.
Yeah. Well, all righty, sir. I've got to run. We run out of time, but I can't tell you how much I appreciated you coming on and giving us your outlook and your take on things. And where can we find you? I know that you're on Twitter. What is your Twitter handle again? I had that in my notes and I'm not seeing it right now.
Absolutely, Zach. It's been a pleasure. My Twitter handle is at TG Macro, just like it sounds. T as in Tony, G as in Greer Macro. I am the editor of the Morning Navigator newsletter, which is a daily publication about global markets. You know, it's my most honest views and opinions, and I've developed a pretty good following so far. And you can find me at www.tgmacro.com. It tells me tells you a little bit more about my history. There are some client recommendation notes on there and a few more things about me and where you can get to know me better. And that's about it. But I can't thank you enough for the West Coast exposure, my man.
Hey, you bet, man. And like I said, it's honest on our part. I really enjoy hearing your take on things. I think you're a really sharp guy. And like I said, you're one of the few guys that has a very rich trading background and also really tracking the macroeconomic side of things. And I can't recommend a follow as much. And I know you and I spoke off air, but you and I are going to have some future conversations about some of your products on the research side that we might be able to use. So I look forward to that as well.
That's fantastic. You're a gentleman, Zach. I can't thank you enough for having me on today. That was a really good time.
Oh, absolutely. All right, Tony. Well, thank you so much for being with us. And thank you guys so much for joining us for this conversation. And as always, we'll be back next week. This is Know Your Risk Radio on AM 770 KTTH.